The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at the data we leave behind, both online and off, and some of the fascinating things that it can reveal about us. We'll talk to information analyst Keith Schoen of technology company Catafora Incorporated about our online data trails and the surprisingly intimate things that they can reveal about our personalities. But first, let's find out what kind of information pharmaceutical companies want to get their hands on and how they plan to use it. I'm here with Jessica Wapner. Jessica is a freelance science writer who covers biomedical issues for places like Scientific American, The New York Times, Slate, and Science. She's also the author of the Public Library of Science blog, Work in Progress, Exploring the Ethics and Economics of Drug Development. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
Now, you recently wrote a post on your blog about pharmaceutical companies mining drug prescribing data to help them perfect their marketing direct to doctors. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm from Canada, where we actually have a civilized healthcare system, so there might be a lot about this process that I'm going to need help with. So first of all, data mining, what does that mean?
The practice that people typically think of when we talk about data mining is pharmaceutical companies buying doctors' prescribing records. So essentially what happens is a patient takes their prescription to a retail pharmacy chain, and those retail pharmacy chains provide the prescriptions stripped of any identifying factors. So it doesn't include the person's name, for example. They sell those prescriptions to third-party companies that are called health information organizations. This is kind of a cottage industry, so to speak, of these third-party people who buy prescriptions from pharmacies and then comb the data, take those prescriptions and break them down into useful pieces of information. And then that information gets sold to drug companies. Now, in the process of mining the data that is held within those prescriptions, they often also combine it with physician identifiers. So they can kind of trace it, even though the prescription itself is stripped of any identifying factors, they're able to trace the prescriptions back to the doctor who prescribed it. And that is very interesting for pharmaceutical companies to know, because then they know who is prescribing what drugs and where they should best target whatever marketing they're going to do for a particular drug.
You can't do data mining without data, and the drug companies have the money to get tons of it. Now, first of all, the drug manufacturers, they aren't gathering and crunching the raw numbers. You said that a third party does that.
Mm-hmm.
So what kinds of records specifically are they combing through?
Well, I mean, just to be concrete, take a company such as IMS, who was in the spotlight during some recent litigation regarding data mining practices. So that company would gather together prescriptions from, say, Walgreens or Rite Aid or whatever major pharmaceutical chain is willing to provide this. And they'll turn a prescription into bits of data. So what's the name of the drug? What was the condition for? What was the length of the prescription? Are there other drugs that this patient had received before? They might be able to get that data. Anything else that would be interesting for a drug company to know about is data. Now, it won't have identifying factors, but it might contain also the gender, the age, information like that that would be useful for a company to know about. What's the condition that it's being treated with the drug, because a drug might have more than one indication. So things like that are the data that a drug company is looking for.
So it's prescription information, but it's also physician identities then?
what I understand about it is that physician identities are not provided by the retail chains, but somehow they're able to link them back to the physician. The Drug Enforcement Agency has identifying numbers for every physician. All of the 700,000 prescribing physicians in the United States have Drug Enforcement Agency identifying numbers. So that means if you're prescribing a drug, the DEA has you numbered, basically. Now, some people have said that the Drug Enforcement Agency identifying number gets provided to a company like IMS Health from the American Medical Association. The American Medical Association has that list of identifying numbers correlated to the physicians they're assigned to. Now, the AMA insists that they do not sell that information. There was an article published in a Vermont newspaper where the AMA responded saying, absolutely not, we would never give DEA identifying numbers to match with physicians. But they do provide information, whether it's the DEA number or something else, they do provide information. And there are other ways for a company like IMS, the Health Information Organization, to find out some other identifier. The AMA is not the only way for them to link prescription data with the physician who prescribed the drug in the first place.
But they're definitely, the AMA is selling lists, even if they don't have those specific identities, and there is some way that the companies are matching these up.
There is some connection with the AMA. I think it would be very difficult to pinpoint exactly what the AMA is doing. The Prescription Project, which is by the Pew Charitable Trust, has also written about data mining, and they also talk about a link between the American Medical Association and data mining. They talk about sale of so-called master file data from the AMA. That's the list that contains the name, the identity, the practice location, the training site, licensure, and also disciplinary history. I don't know where that would come into it, but hey, it's in there for every U.S. physician. So that includes physicians who are not members of the AMA. Now, whether that master file, what happens with that master file, does it get sold to companies like IMS? I can't say for sure. But according to the Pew Charitable Trust Prescription Project, sales of that data brought the AMA almost $45 million back in 2005. So imagine if that's happening every year or even every couple of years or even every 5 years. That's a lot of money. So the AMA might have a hard time turning down opportunities to sell data about physicians.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking to science writer and blogger Jessica Wapner about data mining by the pharmaceutical industry. So what questions are they hoping to answer when examining these prescribing profiles?
Well, if a drug company has a new drug, they want to look for opportunities to increase prescription of that drug. So they're really looking for any openings, which could mean areas where doctors are prescribing competing drugs or the generic version of a drug, or where they haven't adopted a new drug for a disease where a new type of treatment has just been developed. Any opening for a drug company to encourage a doctor to just try their drug, maybe even just once, because even getting one more prescription per doctor is a huge amount of money for a drug company.
Now, the inspiration for this blog post was a case in Vermont that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So this is banned in Vermont.
Well, there was a law banning it. The Supreme Court has ruled that the law is not constitutional.
Can you tell us why it's not constitutional?
According to the Supreme Court ruling, it's a matter of free speech. the Vermont law was essentially trying to block pharmacies from supplying this information. And the Supreme Court ruled that that was blocking free speech, that was limiting free speech. And that is unconstitutional and not going to be tolerated.
The argument in favor of the ban mostly centered around patient privacy, didn't it?
Yes. The argument in favor of this ban and in other states as well was to do with privacy issues for the most part. But I think that we have to be honest when looking at these laws and ask ourselves, okay, are they worried about privacy or are they worried about drug companies making too much money?
Right.
And trying to find ways to curb that, which many states have done. Many states are disallowing physicians from receiving gifts from pharmaceutical companies because there's ties between gifts and a tendency to prescribe the drug from the company that provided the gift.
Color me surprised.
So laws like that are clearly designed to limit the influence of a drug company. So here they are saying that there's privacy issues, which are debatable because on the one hand, the prescription data is stripped of identifying factors. In the U.S., there's HIPAA laws, H-I-P-A-A, that's Privacy Act laws that cannot be violated. However, there's apparently ways around that where data that's been de-identified can later be re-identified if it's matched up with data from a different company than the one that provided it the first time around. So loopholes, as always. I can't tell you for sure whether that's happened or not, but I think that's one of the concerns.
Right.
And now, if you're in a large city, what's the big deal? I mean, about identifying factors like age or gender, but in a small town where a prescription is being filled once a year and that individual wants their privacy protected, you can see where that's an issue. Because if you provide the gender and age and disease of a person, it won't be very hard to figure out who that person is. If you're in an area where, say, a rural area,
right,
and then there's worries that that kind of identification can then affect a person's life in a very significant way.
To be fair, in your post, you mentioned some things that this data mining might actually be useful for, other than helping drug companies market to doctors.
Yeah, absolutely. Data mining has been going on for a very long time. It's been going on for, you know, before electronic medical records have, you know, increased in popularity. We always mine data. We mine data all the time to try to improve what we do. You look at what you do, you look at the results of it, and you sharpen your approach next time around. So that's what data mining is, and we can use data mining to see how are physicians in Maine treating lung cancer versus physicians in Florida or California. There's huge variations in the way that different diseases are treated, and that's problematic because that increases healthcare costs, and it means that some people aren't getting the optimal care. So the movement of cost effectiveness, which is kind of a growing buzzword at the moment, mm-hmm, totally depends on data mining. You can't do it without that. So if you want to check what Dr. so-and-so is doing here and the other doctor in this state, you can't do that without mining some kind of data. So there are many other uses beyond getting pharmaceutical companies more money.
At the end of your piece, you conclude that the resistance to data mining is only a part of the general distaste for commercial healthcare.
Yes. Well, I think that I have a lot to say about that.
Well, in the U.S. at least, all healthcare recipients are consumers, right?
That's right. Healthcare are consumers, and people who purchase a prescription should think of themselves not just as a patient, but as a consumer of healthcare. And there is a huge tendency to kind of castigate the pharmaceutical industry for all of the money it makes. And the pharmaceutical industry does make a lot of money. Also in that Pew Prescription Project report I mentioned earlier, they talk about the pharmaceutical industry spending almost $30 billion on advertising in 2005. If they're spending $30 billion on advertising, you can imagine how much money they're making. Because
right.
It's got to be a lot more than that to make such advertising worthwhile. But drugs are a market-driven product. We don't have a not-for-profit government organization creating pharmaceuticals. And we, at the same time, want access to everything. People don't want to have drugs kept out of their reach if they can't afford it. People don't want to have the FDA not allowing certain drugs to be approved, even though there's no sign that they really benefit people. And at the same time, they don't want the drug industry to be making the money that they're making. I think that the reaction against the volume of profit is totally understandable. There's something kind of
creepy.
Just creepy and stomach-turning about that kind of money. You can't, what is a billion, I can't think of what $1 billion is, let alone $29 billion. And that's, again, just what's spent on advertising. That's not even the profits. And you look at what's going on in the world and the day-to-day suffering that we kind of all go through just to make ends meet, let alone all of the people in the world who don't have access to basic health care. And we know that there's something wrong, but we don't necessarily think of ourselves as a willing participant in that picture. I understand that. I understand that the healthcare industry was created out of our hands and, well, what can we do? But at the same time, there needs to be some kind of recognition that if we don't want a drug industry with out-of-control profits, we can't also have every single medicine at our fingertips.
So basically, this is going to take a complete restructuring of healthcare.
That seems to be where I get to with every issue that comes up in healthcare, is until you take away the current structure where prices are so inflated because of insurance and so tied in with government lobbying and tax loopholes and also not necessarily understanding how to take care of ourselves a little bit better, dare I say it, I don't know what would really change. I don't think that creating a law against data mining in Vermont is really going to impact anything.
I could do an entire radio show called Medically Speaking and never run out of topics.
I totally know what you mean. Yeah.
Thanks very much for being here, Jessica.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You can find biomedical writer Jessica Wapner at blogs.plos.org/work-in-progress. There's also a link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk about online data analysis with Keith Schoen after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I I'm here today with Keith Schoen. Keith works for Cataphora, where he manages the core technology group, which develops new technology for understanding the relationship between human behavior and digital data. He received a Bachelor's of Science from the University of Arizona and a Master's of Science from Stanford in mathematics. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, Desiree.
So understanding the relationship between human behavior and digital data, that is a bit vague. So what does that mean?
The average office worker, as we go about our day, it's amazing the quantity of data that we inadvertently create just as we go about our regular activities. So we get there in the morning and maybe we have to use a key card to get into the office. That's becoming more and more common. And most of these systems are logged and can tell somebody when you came in and out of the building. Then we go sit down at our desk and we start communicating with people using things like email and instant messaging and voice over IP phones, text messages and things like that. And all of these mediums of communication leave behind a trace of what's happened in a digital form. And then we start doing our day-to-day business activities, and we log on to various systems, and we update wikis, and we buy things on credit cards and file expense reports, and all of these things leave behind a record of what we've done. And so my company is in the business of coming by later after some event has happened and using all this data to try to figure out what we can tell about how people in organizations have behaved. And by that, I mean a couple of things. I mean finding concrete facts such as what were you doing, say, last Tuesday night. But I also mean looking for the broad patterns of behavior, anything that we do over and over again. Certify a product is ready to go out the door. It's safe and it works. Hire people. There are certain procedures that tend to crop up over time, whether they're enforced or not. And people do this the same way over and over again. And both that pattern is interesting, but also what's interesting are the deviations, where things are not done the way that they're normally done. And so you can take all of this together and you can form a high-level picture of how these people and how these organizational structures have behaved over time.
So you look for things like very subtle behaviors, though, not just expense reports and when a call was made.
Yeah, we can look for how people's productivity changes from week to week, season to season, you know, how people's diurnal schedule shifts over time, how people feel about various people and various topics, you know, what causes stress, what makes people angry, what makes people happy. How relationships get stronger and weaker over time, who's winning and losing office politics. There are all sorts of things that we can look for.
And what do you use that information for exactly?
Throughout most of the history of our company, never all, but most of our business has been in the legal space. So either there's a civil litigation or there's some government regulatory action. And both sides have a lot of data, too much data to, not too much to have a human being go through every single item, but it would become prohibitively expensive to have a team of human investigators go through all of the items and try to figure out everything there is to know. And so we've been brought in to use our software to figure out what data is useful and what that useful data can tell us. We've been involved in some other instances also, internal investigations, criminal prosecutions, things like that. We recently divested our litigation business that was purchased by Ernst & Young. We're very excited about that. They have some really interesting plans for it. And Cataphora Incorporated going forward is going to be concentrating on writing new software applications based around the same technology for people to install on their own servers or their own personal computers to do this work themselves.
So why would someone want to know this kind of information about themselves then? Because my understanding is this is primarily used by companies who want to catch their employees doing kind of sketchy things or to watch productivity and such.
Yeah, or you know, a sketchy thing has happened that can't be ignored and they want to know who did it.
Right.
That has been traditionally where software has been used for the most part. Actually, we very recently released a consumer version that it's free and any of your listeners can download and run on their own email called the Digital Mirror. And you can go to a website, digitalmirrorsoftware.com. you can download that for free and run a small subset of these analyses on your own email. Now, I should say I don't want to oversell. It's looking at only one person's data, which makes it difficult to see overall relationships, and it has to be written in such a way that it can run on your average desktop or laptop computer. You know, with that said, you can get some really interesting stuff out of that. And you said, why would someone want to know this stuff? Well, there's a few different reasons. One of the big ones is just self-knowledge is golden. It can be very interesting to see what your data tells you about yourself, to see a little bit of how other people see you, and see if there's some things in there that you're doing that you maybe don't want to do. You know, everyone who I know who's run it so far, you know, if they had enough data for it to come back with some interesting results, they've had a moment where they just kind of, you know, stared like, this can't be right. And then they thought about it and they laughed and they said, yeah, actually, that is correct. It's just not how I think of myself. And, you know, this can be some really interesting moments. It also can be a lot of fun for what I would call digital nostalgia. It can be fun to look back and see how your various relationships have waxed and waned over time. Look at which topics were important to you at a given point in time and just see that rerun as kind of an abstract movie of what was going on in your life.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with Cataphora's Keith Schoen about what your digital personality says about the real you. Okay, so you sent me a book written by Elizabeth Charnock, the founder of Cataphora, called E-Habits, and there's a section on digital revelations, the ways in which we use our email and what it tells people like you about us. So let's talk about a few of those. What does the email that I choose to save or delete tell you about me?
That one can be very interesting. Let me just preface this by saying any of these that we're going to talk about, it's important to understand that there are variations in how different people use their email. And what we're really talking about is the deviation from the baseline for a given individual. You know, some people, if you look at their inbox, you're going to see every email they've kept for the last 5 years. Some people clean out things religiously after 3 months. So what we're really interested in are the emails that are unusual for that person. What have I gone to a lot of trouble to save? So, for example, if my email goes back 6 months and there's nothing in my inbox that's previous to that, but I have some special folders where I've set things aside that I didn't want to delete, those emails can be very interesting. You can look at the topics of those emails, and if it's work email, that's going to have mostly to do with your job function. But let's think for a minute about why we save emails. Sometimes we save them because there's important information in there that we don't want to lose. You know, some people will just write that down elsewhere on their computer. Some people will save the email. A lot of the times, people save emails for very emotional reasons. You know, that email praising you for that big presentation that went really well, that invitation to dinner from that really attractive person that you've been wanting to have that happen for a long time. These are the sorts of emails that tend to get saved a fair fraction of the time. You know, by looking at these emails in aggregate, one of the things that's most interesting to us is the list of senders. So, you know, for instance, I can look at the list of subject lines from the emails. Those can tell you something once you already know the story, but they tend to be fairly random. Usually what's most interesting here is the list of people who sent them, and those tend to be the people that we particularly like, we particularly respect, we think are particularly important to us. And so it's a measure of the importance that we put on other people.
How about how I respond to meeting requests or just to social invitations? What does that tell you?
In general, these are going to fall into three categories. If I'm responding to an invitation like that, there will be the things that I accept right away, the things that I reject right away, and then there's everything else. A lot of those are the ones that you sit on, that you don't respond to until the last minute, or the ones that you respond tentative right away. And that takes you forever to switch it into the yes or no category. You know, those are going to be the ones where you're on the edge, where you're trying to figure out, do I have the time to do this? Is there something more important that I'm supposed to be doing or that's going to come along later? You know, so those can be really good indications about what's in that borderline category of what's really important to you right now. Now, again, I'm going to go back to what I said before about the deviations being most interesting. Some people are just terrible at responding to things on time. You know, I fall into this category myself. It takes me forever to respond to things. And other people go through phases where they're just so busy that they can't schedule anything. So it's what you really want to look at are the ones that are really deviating from the norm.
And so when you're saying the things that really deviate from the norm, this would be a symbol of what?
This is a symbol of your priorities, or I should say a surrogate for a way to measure what your priorities are at that point in time. You know, which work topics are the most important to you, which people are the most important to you socially. If you agree to attend two different meetings, but one you accepted right away and one you didn't get around to accepting until the afternoon before it was going to happen, the first one you were able to say immediately, I have to go to that. This is an important thing to me. It's particularly useful because it's not something where you're trying to send that message. It's something where you're, you know, subconsciously sending that message. You're sending that message because of what your actual concerns are. And so that can be a good measure of what's actually important to you.
One of the other revelations is you speak about when someone escalates or de-escalates intimacy. So what does that mean?
That can mean a number of things. One of the most interesting is which channels of communication they use. So if you think about this, for very formal communications, we tend to be as asynchronous as possible. If I write an email, I can spend as much time perfecting it as I want to. You don't know how much time I've spent perfecting it. And I'm giving you the opportunity to take as long as you want to respond to it. You know, on the other hand, IM is much more informal. I'm still allowing you to get up and go away from the computer if you want to. It's usually socially acceptable to say, you know, I'll be back in a bit. But there is a sense of, you know, right now there's a back and forth communication going. As opposed to, you know, a phone call where I'm going to force you to stay on the line for a while and you're actually going to get some of my tone of voice and some of my emotional cues. And then a face-to-face meeting where I'm taking the liberty of possibly taking a large chunk out of your day. What we find is that over time, as relationships get stronger, there's a greater tendency to use one of those later channels of communication that I was talking about and to take more liberties that way. You know, so if the default is that every interaction I have with you, I start with a very formally written email, that indicates a certain level of formality, a certain level of, you know, respect or discomfort or whatever. And by the way, all this falls into the broad category of what we call social proximity. Basically, a measure of the closeness of a relationship, the measure of the confidence you have in a particular relationship. And that could be, you know, either a work relationship or a personal relationship. Other things that we can look at when measuring this are the amount of time that you appear to have spent on an email, how long it is, how much you've checked your spelling, checked your punctuation, checked your grammar, that sort of thing, the number of topics that you talk about with a person, the length of the conversations that you have, how long do your email threads run. There are all sorts of things that we can look at there. And I should also point out that some of these things can be used in other contexts as well. How did we get interested in looking at which channels do people use? One of the ways that we got interested in that was investigating conspiracy cases. In cases where at least one person knows that they're doing something they shouldn't be, it's very common for a communication that begins in one channel to suddenly have a request that they move to a non-recorded channel. You know, like maybe
right.
We should talk about this face-to-face,
right.
That sort of thing. That's slightly different from what I've been talking about because I'm in social proximity. I'm more interested in what's the default for how the conversation starts as opposed to a call me event, which is what I was just talking about, which can kind of be detected in its own thing. But it's important to note that all of these things can be used in different contexts in different ways.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Keith Schoen of Cataphora, and we're talking about understanding your digital character and what it says about you offline. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, show favorite Sharon Birch McGrain returns to tell us about her new book, The Theory That Would Not Die: How Bayes' Rule Cracked the Enigma Code, Hunted Down Russian Submarines, and Emerged Triumphant from Two Centuries of Controversy. We'll learn how this once-overlooked branch of probability theory has played a central role in some of the biggest turning points in human history. And we're joined by computer network researcher Dr. Boleslaw K. Szymanski to discuss his new paper on the conditions under which minority opinions become social consensus. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Keith Schoen, who manages Cataphora's Core Technology Group, which develops new technology for understanding the relationship between human behavior and digital data. Now, even somebody's online etiquette can tell you quite a bit about them. And I have to ask, are the people who seem like horrible people online also horrible offline? Because there's many of those.
Yeah, there are. Not necessarily. You know, it can correlate, but, you know, it's become a very commonplace observation that people are willing to write comments online in an anonymous context that they would never say to somebody's face. That's an extreme example, but there's more subtle versions of this all the time. Very frequently, people just aren't aware of how their online behavior comes across. They don't think about it. They're not transmitting their own emotional cues, their tone of voice, their gestures that would tell other people, that would mitigate what they're saying. And they're not seeing other people's reactions to what they do. You get to project a lot more of what you're thinking onto the other person. And in general, that does lead to more misunderstandings. There's a lot of things that people will do through email that they're just not... You know, it's not that they don't care that it makes you feel bad. It's that they're not understanding the consequences.
Well, let's talk about one of them, the public shamer.
So this comes from part of the book. Elizabeth wanted to coin some terms for types of behavior that we see very frequently in online data that kind of deserve their own description. The public shamer is the one who, it's a sort of a passive-aggressive behavior. When they're upset about something, they want to make sure that other people know about it. They think that will help provide some social pressure to enforce what they think is correct. So, for example, the person at work who asks you for something by a certain date, and when you don't do it, they reply and they copy a whole bunch of other people on that same email. Or that relative who's upset that you didn't call such and such for their birthday and mentions it casually in a larger email that has all of your other relatives copied on it. Those are examples of public shaming.
Oh, I so know those people.
Yeah, and you notice what you said there. You didn't say, I've so noticed those, you know, when this has happened. You said you've noticed these people. There's some people who just tend to do this over and over again. And it's a great example of what we were just talking about. Is this a good idea long term? Well, you know, you do it once in a while, it might have the effect that you intend it to have. But, you know, if you do it all the time, you come off as whiny. And instead of thinking, oh, I feel so bad that that happened to that person, people tend to think, oh, geez, there that person goes again. And, you know, part of why this, if you said something in a group of friends and everyone rolled their eyes and tried to change the subject, you're more likely to notice that than if you send this out in an email where you're not getting that immediate feedback from these other people.
So people just don't register that this is a bad thing online and that it could have the same social repercussions as it does offline?
People are generally less likely to notice this online, yeah.
Now, how about forwarding other people's emails?
Very important thing to be careful about. Conversations online are more permanent than conversations in the real world. In the real world, if the two of us are talking about something and, you know, I say, you know whose opinion I want on this? Bob? I can bring Bob in. Bob doesn't know everything we were just talking about. On the other hand, if the two of us are having an exchange by email and I suddenly add Bob to the distribution list, a lot of the times the entire thread is still in there.
Right.
And this can lead to problems when people aren't thinking through what it is that they're forwarding onward. There are a lot of instances where an email starts with something that's very personal or, you know, confidential business information, and the topic of the conversation drifts over time. So, you know, let's say that we're talking about this very difficult personal situation that one of us is having, and then we start talking about the radio show. And then, you know, after a few more exchanges, we say, hey, let's get your producer's opinion on this. We forward it along, completely forgetting that all that personal stuff was at the beginning of the thread. And this happens more frequently than you would think. You know, I've worked at a company before where some very negative comments about a customer ended up getting sent to that customer because one of the salespeople didn't read what was at the beginning of the thread before forwarding it on. That's a very embarrassing incident, but, you know, fortunately there wasn't any very confidential information in there, you know, information about another customer, for example, or trade secrets or something like that. So, you know, this is definitely something to worry about, and it's something that we look for because it tells us something about the degree of diligence of the person who's doing the forwarding. It tells us something about how careful they are with business data.
So you would use this kind of information in investigations. So what if it wasn't an investigation? Like, what if you were using the personal version of the Digital Mirror software and you found this out about yourself?
It would be something that I would want to watch out for going forward. It would be something that I would want to take a couple of minutes and think about. You know, before adding someone to a distribution list, I always scan down to the bottom and see everything that was in the thread up to that point. If I want them to know the context of the entire thread, great, I want to leave that in. But a lot of times I'll just clip out everything but the last one or two messages. You know, a lot of times that's a good idea, especially if the person who's being added is in a different category than the people who've been on the distribution so far. If you go from your working group to a broader context within your organization, or from people within your organization to adding someone outside of the organization, you want to be very careful about things like that.
Now we have a question from Rick.
Are you ever called on to investigate cheating spouses? If so, how do you do it?
Yeah, I can categorically say that we've never been hired for that kind of investigation. That's not the sort of thing that we do. But is this something to worry about? Yeah, absolutely. There have been some very interesting court cases that have been reported on in the last year or two that have had to do with divorces and the other person's online accounts, email, Facebook, whatever. If we live with someone, you know, it's very likely that they have physical access to our computer. A lot of us don't use passwords, and a lot of people share their passwords with their spouses, and a lot of snooping in that category has been done that way. Yeah, but I can say that. I don't never say never. The future's a long time, but I don't think that's something that we're interested in doing.
Well, let's just say, for conversation's sake, what if you were emailing with somebody and, of course, there weren't those blatant "I'm cheating on you" phrases written, or "let's cheat on my wife"? What are some kind of the subtle behaviors that you would be looking for?
I've known a lot of people want to keep segments of their life separate from other segments, who will maintain distinct online personalities for doing that. And I have seen this come up in investigations before where, you know, people have many different email accounts spread around for, you know, different hobbies, for work versus personal, that sort of thing. And that might be one of the things that you're looking for is, do you see account registration emails for this person creating a lot of other email accounts that you don't know what they're using them for? You might look at where they're spending their time. By looking at someone's electronic data, I can create a histogram of when they're active throughout the day. And in some cases, I can tell where they're active at various points of time. You know, when I'm looking for someone who's doing something illegal, look for recurring gaps of time where they're not where they're supposed to be. And you could do the same thing in a cheating investigation as well, I suppose.
This is super creepy, sir. Really. On so many levels. Now, you monitoring all these behaviors, is any of this actually based on psychology, or is it more about just extending sort of what we see in normal everyday human responses?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I would say on a practical level, it's based on psychology, but I want to be very clear. I don't have a background in psychology, and I don't think we've ever had many people working for us who did. We've hired a lot of computer scientists, mathematicians, professional linguists, statisticians. We've hired people in a lot of different fields, but someone with an academic background in psychology or psychiatry, I don't really think so. I mean, kind of the level where this is coming at for me is, you know, it's in the background. We have someone's mindset in mind when we're developing something. then we test it. And if we look for, you know, we've developed a filter for a particular type of data, let's say for finding angry emails or for finding what appears to be an email where someone's passing the buck to another person. We find that sort of data, and then we see, does it correlate with the sorts of things that we need to find, which are, you know, evidence of the thing that we're looking for. And I can tell you at a practical level whether or not that correlation is there, but I don't want to make, you know, I'm not qualified to make actual statements about, you know, someone's inner life, for example.
So I guess what you're saying then is these kind of behaviors, when taken together, if there was an investigation, some of these behaviors could be seen as potentially incriminating, I guess, as an excuse to look further into someone.
Yeah, and a lot of the time that's what happens. You look for the data, which you know is most likely to lead you to where the interesting stuff is, and then maybe you find a smoking gun that tells you exactly what you're looking for. If you don't find a smoking gun, which, by the way, most of the time you don't, you start trying to build up the broad patterns, and you go through a very tedious process of elimination to, you know, try to throw out all the other possibilities. But what can get you there in the first place is looking for suspicious behaviors. You know, if we suspect a conspiracy, look for signs that people don't want other people to know what they're doing. If part of the allegation is that employees are being asked to do something unethical, look for signs of stress. Signs of stress can be very interesting ways of finding where people are being put in uncomfortable positions. Now, again, when I say signs of stress, I mean linguistic patterns that are associated with signs of stress. And I happen to know that those tend to lead us to what we're looking for without making any definitive statements about what the people's cortisol levels are, for example.
Right. Well, signs of stress would be what?
This is a field known as emotive tone detection. There are various companies out there doing different types of this. We have some unique stuff here, but there's certainly a lot of, you know, at one end, there are various people who go through and try to automatically tag reviews as positive or negative based on linguistic cues in there. We're interested in applying more nuance and separating out, is this angry language or just frustrated or confused or whatever. But there are a lot of things that you can look for. You can look for the language that's being used. You know, they're using terms that are, the obvious thing is, you know, if I'm angry, you want to look for, I'm really angry about this. But you also want to look for things like, I can't believe you're doing this. This is completely unreasonable. And over time, we built up a large library of these. You also want to look at what punctuation people are using, whether they're capitalizing their text. You want to look at sentence length. There are any number of things that can fit into this that, you know, we have a very large staff of very talented linguists who have built up large filters over time for finding these sorts of things.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and Keith Schoen is talking about just how easy it is to know way too much about the real you via the online you. Now, Skeptically Speaking endeavors to be servicey. Now, one would assume that if they aren't involved in any kind of criminal or unethical behavior, then they don't have to worry at all about this kind of thing. So why don't you tell us about why that is completely incorrect?
Yeah, let me start off by agreeing with you. It is completely incorrect. And I don't want to fearmonger. You know, you can be paranoid about everything, and at a certain point you want to, you know, figure out what you're comfortable with, or just go ahead and live your life. But with that said, there's a lot of ways in which your data can suddenly become a lot more public than you meant for it to. For example, you might say, I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not involved in anything bad. But maybe someone else at your company is. And once a lawsuit or you know, a government regulatory or criminal action has taken place, subpoenas are going to start flying around asking for all of the data that deals with topics A, B, and C. And if you are the CEO of the company, you're going to pay some very expensive lawyers to look through absolutely every email that you have and make sure that nothing ancillary goes out the door along with that, extremely personal data, trade secrets, just anything you don't want to have out there, they're going to redact that. If you're, you know, Joe in data entry, much less attention is going to be paid. And they're just going to scan for anything that might possibly be related to topics A, B, and C, and that's going to go out the door. So to give you an example of this, think about the Enron data set. I feel very bad for a lot of the people who worked at Enron. Some of them did some very terrible, horrible things. Others of them knew nothing about that. But all of the data that was subpoenaed for that lawsuit ended up in the public domain. Right now, a lot of people who do various data retrieval techniques, a lot of people who are involved in the e-discovery field, use that data set in order to show off what they can do and how it's the same as or different from everyone else. So if you were working at Enron at the time that all those things were happening, there's a very good chance that all of your email is public at this point. So that's one way your data can get out into the public domain. There's a lot of others. Break-ins and hackers, we all know about this. You know, at this point, there are various people who will go through and try to just grab giant chunks of data to mine through for identity information, passwords, private information, that sort of thing. We'll steal data in great chunks. You know, there are all sorts of ways that the data that you think is yours personally can suddenly get out there into the broader world. The biggest one, actually, that affects more people than you would think of, your employer may be monitoring you. The law changes from place to place. It's very different in the EU. But in the United States, at least, if it's on your employer's computer and there's no contract to the contrary, the data belongs to your employer. And there's a lot of very legitimate reasons why your employer might want to look at everything that's happening on their computers. Your employer can be held liable for any illegal actions you might be committing, for any racist or bigoted actions that you're taking. You know, in certain industries, they may be very heavily regulated, and there may be things that they're being required by the government to look at. So the fact that it's just between you and the guy three cubicles over and you were just blowing off steam and you didn't mean anything by it, that's obvious to you, but it might not be obvious to the head of HR.
Well, we have some questions on that topic from James.
The move to cloud computing means that people's work resides on the internet. What new privacy concerns does this raise?
Let me preface this by saying that we're now going a bit outside of my sphere of expertise. I'm not that kind of computer security person, so anything I'm about to say, take with a grain of salt. I've gone back and forth on this, but at the end of the day, I don't think that cloud computing is necessarily any less secure or any less private than keeping it on your own computer. I'm willing to do online banking without being worried that my money and my purchase history will end up in someone else's account. And a lot of these cloud computing services will offer that level of certification of security. Things are going to happen. You know, hackers are going to break in and steal chunks of data. But frankly, that could happen behind your corporate firewall as well. You're less of a target, but you have less of a security staff probably as well. You know, someone somewhere working at one of these large companies is going to create a human error. But again, you know, people at your corporation, you know, are going to at some point forget a laptop in a taxi cab or something like that. And, I've worked at a company where people, good old fashioned burglars broke in through a first floor window and stole a bunch of our computers. We lost a lot of data. It's much harder to get into the server farm of one of these very large companies offering cloud computing. At the end of the day, I'd look at how sensitive your data is to you and the track record of the provider you're thinking of using. If they have a good track record, do your cost-benefit analysis accordingly.
So does this present any particular obstacle for companies like yours if everything is hosted on a cloud as opposed to on people's personal hardware?
Not necessarily. It really depends. We're not in the business of taking data that we don't have a right to have. Let's be very clear about that. Mm-hmm. In the past, when we've been working in the litigation space, someone's responsible for doing a collection. Again, the data belongs to the employer, so they're going to sweep through the building, either grabbing entire computers to then go image or, attaching drives and making backup copies of everything. And IT department is going to be under, these things are legal requirements. If you're sued, you're required to give this up. So, any competent IT department is going to have a plan for how they're going to do this. So if they're going to move to the cloud, they're going to need ways to access this data. So they're going to have some sort of administrative password to get at all of that. So yeah, it really just depends. In some ways, it could be easier. If it's a government agency that doesn't want you to know that they've got copies of your data, for them to get the data off the computer in your office, it's very difficult for them to do that without you knowing that they've done it. But, in the U.S., we've had all these high-profile scandals where it turned out that there were all sorts of wiretaps being issued through the phone system that the public didn't necessarily know about. You could, if you're doing it on the back end and you have the cooperation, willing or not, of the provider, it's much easier to do that without the end user knowing about it.
And we have a question from Charlie.
Do you think that all our information being online is changing social norms about privacy?
Absolutely. I definitely think that's the case. You just notice giant generational shifts in what's acceptable and what's not. I can remember when people were talking about how the way people were writing emails was horrible and was going to cost them jobs in the future because they were much too informal. It looked like they couldn't spell. They would never be taken seriously. Well, nowadays we just accept that there are different standards for how you write in different contexts because, we just write so many more words than we used to. In the same way, the standards about what appears on Facebook, people absolutely should think about this more than they do. People lose jobs because themselves or someone else posted inappropriate photos of themselves. However, by the same token, the public's more aware of this, and the tolerance for it goes up every year. So there is a libertarian theory, which I've heard on a number of occasions, that there is no right to privacy, and that the best thing for society is to have everything posted so that we're guaranteed that everyone has a better understanding of what is normal. The more things that we hide behind closed doors, the longer people stay in the closet, for example, to use a historical example. I find this a very interesting theory. I don't find it personally very soothing. And I'm not going to be so bold as to predict what's going to happen in the future. I think expectations of privacy are changing, and I don't think anyone can predict with complete accuracy where they're going to end up. Where the backlash is going to be and people are going to start going the other direction.
So one step that people can take is to at least figure out how they are presenting themselves to other people online. And if I had a PC, and I have only wanted a PC once in my life, and that is right now, so I could use this software, I would suggest that everybody else go to Digital Mirror so that they can download this software. Because
thank you. DigitalMirrorSoftware.com. And what Desiree is talking about there, the current version of the software will only run on Windows, and the system requirements are all up on the download page. It will run against Microsoft Outlook or against Gmail. Future versions will run on more platforms and take in more forms of data.
And we're out of time. Thanks very much for being here, Keith.
Thank you for having me on.
You can download the Digital Mirror program at digitalmirrorsoftware.com. And you can find out more about Keith Schoen and Cataphora by clicking the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, keep clicking your way to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking on mind reading, tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.